From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made decades ago with a university professor. Elizabeth Henderson had earned her doctorate at Yale in 1974, but 6 years later she left her academic work on the work of Russian poet Vladimir Mayakovsky to work on a farm in Gill, Massachusetts. For years, she learned organic techniques for growing vegetables. By 1989, she had helped establish one of the first organic CSAs in the country, and it was through Rose Valley Farm in Wayne County. Today, she is a leading voice, both nationally and internationally, on organic farming, CSAs, farm advocacy, and more. One of her main areas of focus is how customers can make little contributions that help farms stay in business. And there's no better time, she says, than the present. That's because the number of farms in the United States continues to slowly decline. A report released by the USDA earlier this year shows there were 1.89 million U.S. farms last year, and that was down about 7% from more than 2 million farms just 5 years earlier. Some local farmers say one way they have kept their work viable is through CSAs. In addition to the benefits for farms and farmers, they say CSAs can also address food insecurity. And you know, I don't know that that's how people think of most CSAs. Maybe your idea of a CSA is a group of people at an office, you know, kind of just combining and getting food drop-offs. Or maybe you think it's kind of bougie. Maybe you don't. Maybe you think, no, this is dirt under your fingernails kind of partnerships that can definitely help with food insecurity. And let's talk about that because, again, no better time than the present. Just looking at local data provided by FoodLink, the rate of food insecurity in the nonprofit's 10-county service area climbed more than 3 percentage points from 2021 to 2022 alone. This hour, we're talking about how many of these trends can affect the other and what it means for all of us, despite our income levels. It's a conversation about CSAs, their image, how they work, how you can sign up, and the reality that farmers are facing now. And it's great to have Elizabeth Henderson with us, the founder and original farmer at Peacework Farm, member of the Rochester Food Policy Council, and author of Sharing the Harvest, among many other things. Welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And welcome on the line to Ruth Blackwell, the owner of Mud Creek Farm. Always great to have Ruth back with us. Hello, Ruth.
Hi, thanks for having me too.
I mean, you could have stayed with Russian poetry your whole career, Elizabeth.
I would have made a lot more money.
I suspect there's a lot of things you could have done that would have made you a lot more money, but that's never been what your life and your ethos has been about. And I just want to say from the outset here, you know, that it's hard to think of anyone who is more sort of truly ingrained with CSAs. And yet, I want to ask both of you right from the start, what do you think the average person thinks about when they think about a CSA? You know, I mentioned some of these office drop-offs and things like that, which can be great. But I have a sense that some listeners think that CSA are for, you know, wealthy people who just want to get farm shares and kind of feel good about it, as opposed to, hey, this is how we're going to address food insecurity. This is how we're supporting farms. How do you think people think about it, Elizabeth?
I don't really know how the average person, or if there is an average person,
you're not an average person,
thinks about CSA. It's when I started doing CSA in this area, we announced that we were going to do it in the winter of 1988, and Allison Clark from the Politics of Food offered to help us recruit members. She thought it was a great idea, and no one had ever heard of anything like it, paying in advance for food that you were promised that would appear over the course of the season, all from one farm.
What did people think?
Well, the people that Allison recruited, were a few of them were people who were chemically sensitive. So they really desperately needed food that didn't have any kind of chemical residue. And then the other people were either active environmentalists or peace activists. So they were people who understood the bigger picture, were aware that so many farms were going out of business. The number is 1.8 million now. The year I was born, there were about 5 million farms.
Amazing.
In the United States. And the number keeps going down. And what CSA was invented for was to help farms stay in business. And there were a lot of different people thinking about how to solve that problem back in the 80s. I don't know if you remember, but there were demonstrations in Washington, D.C. with farmers on tractors who rode all the way to Washington, D.C. to demand that the federal government keep the parity price payments for farm products combined with supply management and conservation measures. And that was dropped in 1979. And they came very close to continuing it, but it lost. And after that, the number of farms continued to drop even more drastically. And that period was kind of a notable crisis in farming country. Because under parity, buyers, the big companies, the processors, were obliged to pay a price to farms that covered the cost of production. And if necessary, farms would produce less in order to raise the price. And any land that wasn't used for crops was used for conservation. And that's what got this country out of the Depression. A lot of farms planting cover crops and planting these beautiful curves instead of planting their rows up and down hills, curving around the edge. You've probably seen the beautiful pictures of what that looks like when farms do that correctly. But the increase of corporate domination in the food system defeated parity pricing. And so farms continue to go out of business. I brought the latest...
you got data.
Census here.
Yeah.
And in Monroe County, we continue to lose farms, just as in the country as a whole. In New York State in 1992, there were 32,306. In 2022, the time of the last census, there were 30,660. Interestingly, the smallest farms of 1 to 9 acres increased by over 1,000 in that period. But the biggest farms were the ones that really increased, 1,000 to 1,999 acres and 2,000 acres of more. The 2,000 acres of more went from 131 to 406 in New York State. And in Monroe County, we've been losing farms. And when people are asked, farmers are asked why, the report for the census was farms that reported net gains in income in Monroe County were 199, and farms that reported net losses were 312.
Wow.
So a farm can only go on losing money like that for so long.
Fewer than 40% of farms are profitable at all,
right,
in Monroe County.
And they're supported by someone's off-farm job, too.
Sure.
That's
sure.
how farmers get health insurance and things like that.
So a couple of more points on this data before I turn to Ruth here. You know, Elizabeth said that in the year you were born, there were 5 million farms in this country. The peak, according to the USDA, was 6.8 million farms in 1935. So again, 6.8 million farms is a peak 90 years ago, and now we've got less than 2 million farms. What is the effect of the concentration of agriculture in fewer hands and bigger farms, Elizabeth?
Well, it means that farmers don't have any control over the prices that they get because the parity system was dropped. There's no pressure on the buyers to pay the cost. So instead, we have the subsidy system where taxpayers pay farms for not having enough money to cover their costs. Or the taxpayers subsidize crop insurance to the tune of 60% of the whole cost of the crop insurance. And that's mainly for the biggest farms. A farm like Ruth's or a farm like mine doesn't have crop insurance. Our crop insurance was growing many different crops. So in any given season, there would be a few things that wouldn't do so well or might fail altogether, but there would be enough so that the share for the members would be good. So CSA was designed to help farms stay in business.
And let me just step in. A couple people have asked you once again, CSA stands for what?
Community Supported Agriculture.
And again, you are paying a farm in advance, knowing that you are supporting them, they can count on your income. It's like being a sustaining member of WXXI.
Exactly.
It's actually what it is. And when the crops come in, then you get your delivery. And there's different levels of, there's different kinds of CSAs, but that's CSA, Community Supported Agriculture. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
And what's so interesting is when I was groping for a way to start a farm and keep it solvent, some of the leaders of the African American farming movement, the great agronomists of Tuskegee Institute, were asking the same questions. George Washington Carver, and then Booker T. Watley. And Watley came up with the idea of a prescription farm where people would become a member and they would come out to the farm and do U-pick. And he wrote this wonderful book, How to Make $100,000 on 25 Acres, which I read when I started my farm. But I couldn't do all the enterprises that he listed. He included vegetables and berries and livestock and eggs and you pick flowers, just beekeeping, all the different kinds of enterprises that you could combine so that a farm could make a living. And in Mississippi, it was even more urgent because at that time in the 70s and 80s, and going back to the 1920s, an African-American farmer who was too successful risked being burned out by his white neighbors who were jealous of his success, and they could get away with it.
Okay.
Unfortunately, CSA started without knowing about what Booker T. Watley was doing in the South, and I haven't been able to find any examples of farms that still exist that learned from him. There must be some. But the CSA idea was to, like, form a club of supporters around your farm.
And again, in 1988 is when you started it?
Yeah, 1988-89.
And that's really the roots of it here in our area, and there's some of the history for it. Ruth Blackwell, do you have a CSA at Mud Creek Farm?
Say that's 100% of my business is CSA.
And let me ask you, how do you think the average person thinks about what a CSA is?
Well, I find that on average, people still don't know what it is. Maybe they've heard of it, you know, in passing, but they don't actually understand the concept. So often when people ask me what I do and I say I run a CSA, they need explanation. But I'd say on average, my average member, I used to work for Liz. So I worked on Piecework Farm for 4 years. And I think her membership was a little bit more older. So a lot of them had been with Piecework for a long time and were there for sort of political reasons or understood what CSAs were trying to solve, what the problem that CSAs were trying to solve. I think most of my members don't necessarily know. They're younger on average. A lot of them have small children, and a lot of them don't necessarily know the reason for CSAs to exist, but they appreciate what it is on a pretty basic level. A lot of them want to teach their children where food comes from because they feel a disconnect from that in their normal life. They want to be able to show their kids, you know, how things grow, how to pick a pea, all of that stuff. And I think a lot of them sort of miss the idea of, like, going down the road to the local farm and buying eggs directly from a farmer. So they intuitively understand the reason for it to exist. But that's my average member. I think on average, most people still don't know really what it is.
Well, and so here's how we're kind of laying out this hour. And listeners, if you've got questions or comments about CSAs, Community Supported Agriculture, our guests have just about more expertise than I can imagine to help answer any questions you have about how they work or have you tried them, you know, what you get out of it. And it's 844-295-TALK. If you want to call the program, it's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. We're talking, especially in this first part of the program, about just the reality for farms right now. And the reality is that we see fewer and fewer farms. You not only heard the data from the USDA, but Elizabeth Henderson's data collected from New York State, from Monroe County, indicates that the story is, yes, we see a little bit more in the way of 1 to 9 acre farms, the smallest farms, but the middle size is totally hollowed out, and it's the big farms that are growing. Everything else is kind of pulling back, and you know, we're getting more and more concentration of agriculture. And that's not necessarily a positive trend. So we're talking about what that portends for farmers and how difficult it is and why they can often rely on CSA and these kind of relationships. In our second half hour, we'll talk more about food insecurity and what it means, especially for rural counties, and maybe how this all fits together here. But Ruth, when you think about the history of CSA, it's a little surprising to hear you say that, you know, most people still don't know what it is, but I'm getting emails to that effect too. So I've got to remind myself that it still may be a new concept for most people. How do you describe to them what they're going to get out of it, Ruth?
Well, I usually stress that it's a personal relationship with your farmer. Like it's cutting out the middleman. So people who would benefit from my CSA are usually about 20 minutes away because I ask people to come to the farm to pick up their share. Although I do have a pickup in the city too. I've stopped trying to be everything for everyone. So I've sort of created a farm that's the right fit for really local families. So I describe it as a way to get very local produce, very fresh produce, a large variety of produce so people can try new things. I give people recipes to try the newest, weirdest things. And then I also have a big pick your own section so that people can really just sort of treat the farm as their own garden to a certain extent. I think I sort of try and stress that it's something that used to be pretty normal and we've lost in this country, and that you know, it's for the people who it works with, they come back every year, you know.
Mm-hmm. A bunch of the members pick up at the Abundance Food Co-op, and they might go out to Mud Creek maybe a couple times to do some U-pick.
We're trying to get them to come out more.
But that the group that picks up at Abundance is organized by the Peacework Core Group that still exists. It's its 35th year. There are still some of the members who've been in for most of those 35 years, and then some new people. I used to be a member as the representative of the farm, but now that I'm retired from farming and I live in the city, I am a member of the core group, and I help get it organized. And what it does is it means that the pickup takes a place once a week on Thursday evenings from 6 to 8 at the Abundance Co-op, and it's staffed entirely by the volunteer members of the CSA. And the core group runs that schedule, gets people to sign up. Lori Bryce is one of the members who's the sign-up wizard this year, and people staff the pickup area from 5:30 to 8, and then they clean up. And that means that Ruth and her other farmers can just leave the food at Abundance, and they don't have to spend their time being there. It makes it very easy for them to have a significant portion of Ruth's customers in the city. And it's the 35th year that we're doing it, so that's the pretense under which I'm here. Pretty amazing to keep a volunteer effort going for 35 years.
35 years, and some people have been doing it almost every one of those 35 years. That is pretty remarkable. Ruth,
we have members whose children are now members, with kids of their own. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I mean, generation to generation, that relationship with the farm is. I know it's important to so many people and so many of your members, but can I also ask you, Ruth, what I was asking Elizabeth? When you think about the concentration of agriculture in fewer and fewer farming operations that are larger and larger, what do you think the impact is really just on all of us, that's where farming has been going?
I think there's a big disconnect for people now. In even just understanding what goes into producing their food and where it happens and who's touched it, and like people just have no idea. And I think that's a loss for everybody. I mean, I think about my mom. She grew up in New Jersey, and she would get on her bike and ride down the road for eggs, you know, and they were surrounded by farms. She was a little bedroom community, but right outside of that was all farmland. And everybody had stuff for sale. And that whole area is completely paved now. You know, like they don't have, none of the kids growing up in that neighborhood now have any idea what a chicken looks like, you know? I think there's a huge disconnect. And when there is that disconnect, the things that impact your food system, if you don't understand how it works in the first place, you don't have any say in how it's being run, because you don't understand it anyway. So I think that losing that connection between the consumer and the producer is detrimental to everybody.
And now I guess the extension to that is there anything that would arrest this trend that both of you can see? I'll start with you, Ruth. I mean, again, the numbers. 6.8 million farms in the United States in 1935. That was the high watermark according to the USDA. Now there's fewer than 2 million farms. And year by year, we see that drip, 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 that contraction. What would change that, Ruth?
Well, I think that there's different things that will change that. On a very micro level, CSAs can change that just by person in education. Because I think that people who have learned about CSAs or learned how to buy locally and learn the difference will probably never go back. But the other thing is all about money. Like the way our, and Liz will have more data than I will, but the way that the system works right now, a farmer can get subsidies for very specific crops, but not for vegetables per se. So it's a safer bet for a farmer with a bunch of land to grow things that have an insurance policy behind it from the government, which means that, you know, most of the produce we're getting here is grown in California or a different country.
I'm a member of the Northeast Organic Farming Association, and I believe Ruth is too. And yes, NOFA does a lot of policy work, both on the state and federal level. And we are tied into a huge coalition of other organizations, the National Organic Coalition, the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, the National Family Farm Coalition. And we are all working together to try and get the Farm Bill, which is under consideration right now in Congress, to change, so that we can change federal policy and stop supporting the biggest farms and subsidizing corn and soybeans that's mainly feed for livestock or ethanol or shipped abroad, and shift to growing food for people that's high quality, a lot more that's organic, a lot more farms for the many young people who would like to do farming, the Black people who have been kicked off their land because of all kinds of discrimination, including from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We would like a transformative farm bill, and there are more and more of us working on it now than there ever used to be. I don't know whether how it'll go this time, but I think we'll do well enough this time that we will be able to write the farm bill in 5 more years.
Well, if you're just joining us, our guests are talking about not only their work and their careers in farming, but the state of farming, the value that CSAs, community-supported agriculture, brings to farms and farmers, and the value that it brings to the people who are members of CSAs as they try to deal with these trends. I think it was 2014, Megan Mack, might have been 2015, that I did a show on the subject of farming under 40. We talked to farmers who were choosing this profession and who were, young, and the older I get, under 40 sounds very young to me. But the question at the time was, you know, who's choosing this profession? Well, you got all these choices of careers. Who is choosing the profession? Especially people who didn't grow up in a farming family. And we had a whole panel of people, and I think, and I'm trying to remember, I think maybe one is still in farming 10 years later, something like that. I'd have to go back and look. But I mean, over the years, I've heard from them, and they would talk to me about, I'm leaving. Some are moving out. Some moved out of state. One moved out of country, and how difficult it was just to keep going as a farmer. And you know, it's kind of heartbreaking. I wonder what that's like for you to hear those stories, Elizabeth.
Well, the global industrialized food system is stacked against us. So what Ruth is doing and what I did is really impossible, but we're able to do it because we get the support of people who understand how wonderful it is and how health-giving to eat food that's freshly grown and that's grown with the kind of care and attention that's used on an organic farm and on a smaller farm. And I think Rochester and cities like this have a tremendous opportunity to produce a next generation of farmers. There are several schools that have school gardens. Every school could have a garden in Rochester. There's enough space. And then the youngsters who like it could be selected out for the summer programs where kids are paid to grow with Taproot or some of the other organizations. Cooperative Extension also has a couple of training gardens. And the ones who really like that could be singled out, and the city could help put together the resources so that those people get the training and then the land and the resources that they need to grow food. It would only take less than a million farms like Ruth's and mine to feed everybody in this country.
Isn't that amazing?
Local organic food. It's highly skilled work, and it means that the farm work is enjoyable. At a bar the other night, I talked to a couple of the people who work for Ruth, and one of them said this is his second year there, and he just loves working there because he had been working in a warehouse. And now he's working outdoors, and he's working for someone who's really encouraging and fun to be with. Mm. And when you work at a smaller farm, it isn't the kind of back-breaking, spirit-crushing work. That's what happens on the biggest farms. In this country, farm workers are among the worst-paid people. The quality of their work is horrible. Many of them, at least half, are undocumented, so they're always ill at ease. They could be arrested and deported anytime. And more of the others are now H-2A workers, guest workers who are imported into the country to work for a set period of time, and then they go home. And if they're lucky to work for a highly ethical, smaller farmer, they may be treated really well while they're here. Most of those H-2A workers, however, are working for farm labor contractors who commit the worst kinds of violations of human trafficking, holding the identity papers of those workers, providing them with lower pay than they promised, worse living conditions than they said they were going to get. And there are fewer people working for the federal government, for the Department of Labor, enforcing those labor standards. So what's going on right now is just a mess. And we have the power to change it.
You're saying it doesn't have to be that way. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Ruth, you're a certified young person. Do you ever think about stopping and doing something else?
I'm the same age as you, Evan.
I'm not young anymore. Oh, no. Oh, no. No, 45 is young. Come on.
I don't know if we're certified anymore.
No, it's changing.
I mean, there are days when, you know, I'm about to harvest lettuce and it all gets shredded by hail, and you know, there are days where it's rough and I'm like, what am I doing? But honestly, no, I don't plan on doing anything else.
I did drive through, by the way, a crazy hail burst yesterday, and I thought I immediately always think about farms and farming operations. I hope I hope that didn't bother your farm, Ruth.
It missed us, thank God.
Oh, boy, oh, boy. Yeah. Did you want to add to that, Elizabeth? Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say that the people who get Ruth's food and the food from the other CSAs in this area, from Felon's Family Farm or Wild Hill Farm, are so appreciative. It makes all the hard work of farming worth it when people are so genuinely grateful for what you provide to them. It's quite different from a lot of other jobs, and it makes up for at least some of the low pay. And I wrote this book about CSA, Sharing the Harvest. The first edition was in 1998. The second edition was in 2007. And then, as Mari, who works for you, noticed, it was translated into Japanese. It's been translated into both mainland Chinese and Taiwan Chinese and Spanish, Compartiendo la Cosecha.
And as a result, pile of books.
As a result of that, I am the honorary president of Urgency, which is an international network of CSAs. In the United States, there's the CSA Innovation Network, and NOFA is a part of that. But Urgency really covers the globe. And through the symposia that we have every 3 years internationally, I've gotten to know even CSA farmers from Palestine. I correspond regularly with a man named Sag Dagher, who has a CSA near Ramallah on the West Bank in Israel. And he said that he developed CSA as a way to help protect his people from the kind of conflict that they've had and the oppression from the Israelis under that apartheid system that they live under. Because if they can grow their own food, grow their own fertility by rotating the crops and growing cover crops and composting and recycling everything, then they don't need very much from the Israelis. Saad and his people grow their own seed and exchange seed with one another. So it's a way of farming that really supports a small-scale farm in endangered Palestine or right here in Monroe County.
Well, after we take this only break, we're going to talk to our guests about how they see the impact of their work and CSAs on issues like food insecurity. And I've got numbers here. You know, the data is really tough, too, when you see food insecurity rates, especially in rural counties, but really everywhere. We're talking to Elizabeth Henderson in studio, who was the founder and the original farmer at Peacework Farm, created that first CSA back in 1988, and is a member of the Rochester Food Policy Council. Sharing the Harvest is her book that she's got a stack of them translated into many languages. The book's been around the world. Ruth Blackwell on the line with us, the owner of Mud Creek Farm. And we're right back with them on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, University of Rochester professor and author Michal Raz joins us to talk about her new book about the state of the child welfare system in this country and why, for over the last 50 years or so, the system has moved into almost a purely punitive one instead of one that supports families in poverty, families who care about kids and are struggling. We're going to talk about how she sees the system and how she thinks it could get better next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our thanks to Foodlink, I think, provided. Yeah, thanks to Foodlink for providing these food insecurity numbers. Of course, Foodlink works on these issues every day, and they track these numbers. And the latest data we have in our region, 10 counties, the highest rate of food insecurity is in Allegheny County. 14.3% of people who live in Allegheny County are food insecure. That generally means that they don't often know where the next meal is going to come from. You're often living paycheck to paycheck if you're paid, and food is a struggle for you or your family. Allegheny County, 14.3%. Seneca County, 13.1%. Orleans County, 12.6%. Yates County, 12.2%. Then you've got Monroe County right at 12.1%. But then right there, right around 12%, Genesee County, Wyoming County, Wayne County, Ontario, Livingston. The rural counties in this state have some of the highest levels of food insecurity, and Elizabeth Henderson has said it doesn't have to be that way. So why is it that way?
Well, part of the reason is that the farms are growing seed and feedstock for ethanol, and so much of the corn and soybeans are exported. There's no encouragement from federal policy for farmers to give up those subsidized and encouraged crops and grow food for people. And besides, if you grow food for people, it takes more workers. It takes a whole different kind of organization. And that used to be what we had. There were many small farms, and you would get from the farms in your neighborhood. And it could be that way again. So much of the land that's used for that feed for the corn and soybeans is rented anyway. So we could re-rent it and repopulate it with the many people who are coming to this country as refugees and come with farming skills, or the farm workers. This area, there's Alianza Agricola, an organization of dairy farm workers. They would love to have land to grow food on, not feed, and have the opportunity to have a cooperative farm that would feed them and a lot of other people as well.
But that's federal policy you're looking at, right?
Well, state policy can support that as well. And there are some state measures. The state now encouraging localities to spend up to 30% on locally grown food. If the Good Food Bill is passed, then any institution in the state, the schools and prisons and stuff, will be able to buy from local farms that have some of the values involved in being either small or local or BIPOC run or humane animal practices, things like that. So there is state legislation that will encourage that. We're moving slowly in that direction, but we could take a big leap forward by changing some of the federal laws as well.
Ruth, how do you see that?
Yeah, I agree. It is risky. You know, farming is risky business, so it is a big leap for people to switch from a less risky business to a more risky business, to switch to growing food instead of feed. If there was some incentive for that, I think more people would do it, because I think people want to do it. They just, you know, they can't risk it all.
Ruth, how do you see the question of labor? You heard Elizabeth talking about labor and, you know, some of the, I think Elizabeth would maybe charitably put it backwards ways, that the issue of labor is dealt with in U.S. farming. How do you see that?
I grew up with dirty hippie parents, and we were actually on an apple picking crew when I was a little kid. And I think my parents were the only people out there in that orchard who were from this country. I mean, most of our food system in this country is completely reliant on immigrant labor. And they are very skilled and very quick and would be hard to replace with local labor who wouldn't be able to work as fast or as hard for as little as they're paid. It's a very complex and ingrained system that's I don't see it changing without big governmental change, really.
But well, one of the ways, I mean, that more of those people, those immigrant workers, could be real local people would be to make them citizens, just grant them citizenship.
I mean, honestly, I would hire any of them in heartbeat. Having seen how fast they are at harvesting lettuce, I would take them in right now if I could. You know, it's harder and harder. I mean, I'm very lucky right now. I have a dream crew. And I do like to hire you know, people who are interested in getting into the farming industry themselves, because I learned on the job, it's not a very lucrative business. So if I can help more young farmers step up and learn a bunch of skills that they can then, you know, put towards their own business, I love that. So I'm lucky right now. I have some really great workers who I could see being the next farmers in this area.
Patrick writes to the program and says, regarding land management and usage, our society doesn't reward or compel most people to be stewards of the land anymore, nor with the skill set to leverage it. Do you agree with that, Elizabeth, that things have changed and our society does not encourage, incentivize, reward people to learn how to be stewards of the land, that we're more disconnected from the land?
I don't know that our society has historically done a very good job of that anyway. Half of the topsoil on this continent has been blown away because of farming practices over the past 100 years or so. But I think people who are attached to a piece of land and care about it can be excellent stewards. One of the fights in the Farm Bill right now is over conservation money. The conservation programs are heavily over applied for by farmers. There are a lot of people who want to be doing conservation, planting cover crops, planting barriers to protect waterways, putting up fencing so that they can have livestock and keep the livestock out of the streams, all kinds of measures like that. But the House Ag Committee wants to take the money that was designated for conservation and switch it over and use it for subsidies that would mostly go to the biggest sugar and cotton growers in the South. So it's a big fight that's going on. If people pay attention and contact their congressional representatives and say, we have to really fight hard for a conservation bill, perhaps we will get it, and that will make a difference. There's a lot more money right now available in New York State for conservation. 2 years ago, we passed the Soil Health and Climate Resiliency Act. It was passed unanimously in both the Senate and the Assembly in New York State, and it resulted in a great increase in the funding available for the soil and water conservation districts that have an agricultural environmental management program that any farm can sign up for. And through being enlisted in that program, you can apply for climate resilient farming grants. And there's four times as much money now available for that as there used to be.
Let me turn to Ruth, and I'm thinking about Patrick's point about just how in touch we are with the land, and are we encouraging people? I take Elizabeth's point that maybe we haven't done a good job of that for a long time anyway, but you know, Patrick sees a lot of disconnect. And you know, just like a small example for me, Ruth, now that I'm 45, I found out last month that I can't just do work in the yard all day if I want to be able to stand up straight the next couple of days. So I try to space it out now as I get older. 30 minutes here, 30 minutes there, go for a run, come back, get some work done. Those lilies are just going everywhere, and they just are incorrigible, and they have to be controlled. But I can't do it all in one day. But I have a great sense of satisfaction whenever I get a chance to actually just look out and say, wow, this looks, I'm very proud of how it looks. I feel good about it. There's dirt under my fingernails. It's been a lot of work, and it has been worth it. And that's a small, I'm not growing food. I'm not feeding neighbors. But I even have a sense of, hey, I've created a better, more beautiful, more harmonious place through dirt under my own fingernails. And I'm not an expert, but I love that. And I think part of what Patrick is saying is there's fewer and fewer people even doing that. We want to mechanize everything. We want to outsource everything. And then now we want people to be farmers. We're not in touch with the land like we used to be. Maybe, again, Elizabeth would say long, long ago. But are you sensing that too, Ruth, that we are just less and less in touch with the land?
I mean, personally, I have dirt under my fingernails all the time.
All the time.
All the time. But yeah, definitely. And I think that's part of why my members love this place, because they you know, they may live in a place where they can't garden or don't even have a yard. Like if you're living in a condo or in the city, you might not even have that opportunity. But if you have a place where you can go experience it on a small level, I think it's really important. I think that some people are starting to realize what they've missed out on. I mean, I think about my parents. My parents moved out into the middle of nowhere, Vermont, for that very reason. They were of that generation of back to the landers, you know, who grew up in the suburbs and realized that they were missing out on something, missing out on a connection to their planet that they didn't grow up with and they wanted to create for themselves. So I think it's always a struggle, you know, but I think there's a lot of, every generation has that group of people who realize they need to go out and find it.
Well, before we let the hour go, then, the reason we got together here together in the first place is because Elizabeth Henderson reached out and we're talking about CSAs, community supported agriculture. At a time when farms are shrinking, it is harder and harder for farms to stay in business. You know, fewer than 40% of farms in Monroe County are profitable, and nearly 2/3 are not. And, you know, we want to convince more people to do this and not just turn this over to larger and larger operations and the CAFOs of the world. Well, you know, what's the role that we have? So if you want to join a CSA, Community Supported Agriculture, Elizabeth Henderson, I think most farms now offer something, right? I mean, 1988, you were the first. No one knew what that was when you were doing that in 1988. Now, how many farms don't have a CSA, Elizabeth?
I think in this area there are about 30.
Okay, so there's plenty.
Most of the CSAs offer a sliding scale payment schedule. You don't have to pay it all up front. And if you have a lower income, you can pay less. I know that Ruth does that for Wild Hill. And NOFA, the Northeast Organic Farming Association, has a farm share program where NOFA has raised money to subsidize shares for low-income people. And if we can get more funding, that will spread to more and more farms. It's also possible to use SNAP payments, the EBT payments, to join a CSA. And it's been a big struggle to get that program to accommodate CSAs because the government only wants you to pay for food that you've already received rather than paying in advance for food that you're going to get. But we've made some headway with that, and you can either even pay for CSAs with SNAP online. So it's not just for rich people. And stores like Abundance, the food co-op, have Abundance has this wonderful program called Flowers, fresh, local, and organic within everybody's reach. So people who are on, who get SNAP immediately can qualify for Flowers and get bargains at a lower rate and afford to eat organically grown food, even if you have a smaller budget. I mean, my budget, I basically live on Social Security. And I eat what Ruth grows, the food from my garden, and what I buy from Abundance. And that's it. I don't shop anywhere else.
30 seconds. What do you grow in your garden these days?
I grow things to complement what's in the share. So some cherry tomatoes and some arugula and salad greens and herbs, things that I can combine with what I'm going to get from Ruthie.
And Ruth, if people want to sign up for a CSA, how would you advise them to do that?
I would advise them to do it in the winter because that's usually when we're trying to get members. I'm actually full right now. But if you go on Google and just say CSA near me, you'll see a lot pop up. We have a lot in our area. I will say if anyone wants anything for their garden, we're having a plant sale at the farm on Memorial Day, 10 to 4.
Where's
the
farm?
In the house. So.
Where's the farm?
My farm is at... It's on Cherry Street in Victor, and we're on the Google Maps, so people can find us.
And Friday evening, May 31st, there will be a plant swap at the public market, so people can come and get plants for their gardens.
So plant swap on Friday the 31st, that's 8 days from now at the public market. You can go out to Mud Creek Farm. What is it? On Memorial Day, you said, Ruth?
Yep. Monday, Memorial Day.
Monday, Memorial Day. Mud Creek Farm out in Victor. They would love to see you there. And maybe you'll have people ask to be put on your waiting list, Ruth. That's a good problem to have. That's a good problem
to have. I have a waiting list.
There you go. What's the next CSA shipment going to look like, Ruth, as we close?
Well, our first share is coming up mid-June, and it's going to have a lot of greens and some kohlrabi and some turnips and radishes and all that good spring stuff.
Thank you, Ruth Blackwell, for taking the time and always making it for this program. We always appreciate what you do.
Thank you.
Ruth Blackwell is the owner of Mud Creek Farm in Victor, and Elizabeth Henderson, the founder and the original farmer at Peacework Farm. And Elizabeth's book is Sharing the Harvest. I had Diana wanted to know real quick, where do they find it? Can you still find the book?
You can still get it from Chelsea Green Publishers.
Chelsea Green Publishers. Google that. The book is called Sharing the Harvest. It's in multiple languages. Elizabeth Henderson, great having you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
More connections coming up in just a moment.